All right, well, we get back to Acts chapter 23 this morning, where Paul is in the protective custody of Rome. Claudius Lysias has recently found out that Paul is a Roman citizen, and so he is, of course, panicked. He is freaking out because he realizes that he has had Paul arrested, and he was about that close to having Paul flogged before Paul finally let the cat out of the bag that, okay, wait a minute, I'm a Roman citizen, don't do that. And of course, the penalty for arresting and beating a Roman citizen before he was actually charged, convicted of a crime, was pretty swift in the Roman Empire. Arrest, certainly. Execution, potentially. So that's something that Claudius Lysias, of course, does not want to get mixed up into. So he sets up a preliminary trial for Paul, and it's before the Sanhedrin, and you can kind of get the wrong idea there. It seems like the Sanhedrin is kind of running that trial, and they're not. That was not the case. Now, we already studied this, verses 1 through 10. And that's not the case. This was the tribune, Claudius Lysias, throwing them both in the same space, the Sanhedrin with Paul. So it's Rome that is in charge of this preliminary trial. And Claudius Lysias's intentions are to hopefully establish a valid charge against Paul that he can carry forward to an inevitable trial before Felix in Caesarea. But worst case scenario, this guy is hoping to at least establish some facts about this case so that he can begin to build his defense for this inevitable situation with Felix, where he's going to have to answer the question of why is Paul, a Roman citizen, under arrest? You better have a really good reason for that. So that's what this trial is all about. And it just did not go well from the start. It was just a disaster from the very beginning because Paul opens up his opening statement by saying, "Brothers, Jewish brothers, I have always had a good conscience before God." And that just, oh man, that just enraged the Jews. For Paul to say something like that, that he could actually believe that having defected from Judaism, the way they saw this, the tradition of their fathers, the law of Moses, and yet stand up bold-faced, without cracking up, without letting you know he's joking. No, he seriously and brazenly said, "I have a good conscience before God." And so that, of course, has absolutely just caused that first meeting with the preliminary trial to just go wrong immediately. And that was enough to get Paul struck across the face. And then Paul, of course, responded by shooting off at the mouth. Seems like a measured response for such an eventuality. You get struck across the face, you might be tempted to shoot off at the mouth. And the only problem is that he shot off at the mouth to the chief priest Ananias himself. He called him a whitewashed wall. Now, it was Ananias who made the statement that the guy next to Paul, "Hey, you over there, you're close to Paul. Because of what he just said, smack that dude across the chops." We assumed that that happened because that's when Paul shot off at the mouth. But Paul did not realize it was Ananias, the high priest, that had given that command to have him struck. And so what Paul actually did was defile the high priest, definitely a no-no according to Old Testament Jewish law. And now Paul finds himself in a bit of a dilemma. He's got to know there's no good way out of this. There's nothing that I can say that's going to cause this trial to go well. And Paul, I think, just ingeniously decides, you know what? What can I do to take the pressure off of me and put it on the council? What can I say to turn the council against themselves and have them consuming themselves like the snake that saw the little worm pop up out of the dirt. And so he scarfed it down and scarfed it down and scarfed it down. And bigger and longer that worm became until he realized he had scarfed down his own tail and half of his body. Well, that's what Paul decided to do to the council. He decided to make a statement that he knew would cause the place to erupt. And boy, did it ever. It worked. The place erupted in violence. Pharisee against Sadducee. Ultra-conservative against ultra-liberal. The whole thing devolved into violence. I take that to mean physical violence. This wasn't the snowflake generation. Violence to the snowflake generation is, oh my goodness, you didn't use my preferred pronouns. No, this was violence. This got physical, and I wish I could know what was going through Paul's mind at that time. You know, just sitting back and, this is interesting, a little bit of fun. And don't act like you don't understand that. I think you kind of enjoy it when you see the atheist devouring one another online, disagreeing with themselves, contradicting themselves, arguing one among the other. It kind of feels good. It appeals to that fallen, sick part of our nature a little bit. But Paul had successfully done it. He had turned the Sanhedrin, the council, against itself. And the tribune finally ordered Paul to be pulled out of there before he was torn to pieces. And Paul is once again in the protective custody of Rome. That is where we find him as we pick up here in the narrative. He is safely protected by Roman soldiers there in the barracks of the Antonia Fortress. And we're going to read now, beginning in chapter 23, verse 11, and try to finish this whole chapter, which is going to end with Paul sitting down there, or I should say up north, in Caesarea, awaiting trial before Felix. Verse 11, the following night, so not the night of the preliminary trial, but the night after that, the following night, the Lord stood by him. The Lord stood by him. None of the unbelieving Jews stood by him. You say, well, Arlen, that's obvious. Of course they wouldn't. But hey, I mean, Paul did turn the Pharisees back to his side a little bit there by getting them arguing about the resurrection. The Pharisees came around and said, yeah, you know what? We agree with Paul on that. And we can't stand the belief of the Sadducees because they don't believe in a resurrection. But no, it wasn't a hard enough turn for the Pharisees to stand by Paul in the rest of this trial. But more disturbing, neither did any of the believing Jews in Jerusalem come and stand by Paul's side. Not a one of them took Paul's side. You know, you ask the question, where is the church in Jerusalem? This is a Christian. This is Paul. I know he's not from the Jerusalem church, but why aren't they there supporting Paul? Well, the answer to that we know is in the fact that even the believing Jews in the church at Jerusalem have a bit of a problem with Paul, don't they? They would be fine with Paul teaching Gentiles that they don't need to live according to the law of Moses, but because rumor has spread around town and it's been taught to them that Paul has been instructing Jews that they don't need to abide by the law of Moses to be saved by Christ, that has soured the opinions of the believing Jews there in the Jerusalem church. And not a one of them showed up to support Paul. And I think worst of all here is, where is James? James is the pastor of the church in Jerusalem, the senior pastor. He is the brother, the half-brother of our Lord Jesus in his flesh. And it was his fault that Paul ends up where Paul is. All James would have to do is show up and say, look, guys, this was a complete misunderstanding. The only reason this happened is because Paul took my counsel and he decided to do this very Jewish thing in the temple, and some lies were made up about him. It's all a misunderstanding. Would you guys just let Paul go? All that he was trying to do was patch up the hostility that existed between him and the Orthodox Jews of Judaism. But not even James shows up. Paul has no one to stand by him except for the Lord. And that was enough. That's always enough. If the Lord is on your side, you are going to be just fine. Even when the rest of the world is against you, doesn't matter. It's actually a great place to be in your spirituality, to reach the point where you realize that when it all comes down to it, the Lord is the only one that is always going to be there by your side. He's the only one guaranteed in this life that will not desert you, abandon you, depart from you, forsake you. He's given us those promises in His Word. I will never leave you or forsake you. I will be with you to the end of the age, to the end of the world as we know it. The Lord has given us those promises. And that's the only sure friend you're going to have by your side throughout all of life. You may be blessed with a good family, and maybe they're there for you all the time. Maybe they've never failed that yet. Maybe your church family has been awesome, and the church family has never let you down. They've always been there by your side. Wonderful. And man, you just feel like you can trust us. We love that. We love to hear those kind of things. And we're so glad that you feel like you can trust us. But be careful, because no matter who it is in an earthly suit, I'm talking about earthly bodies here, we have the potential to fail you. We have the potential to not be there standing by your side, supporting you when you feel like you really need it. Your family may fail to be by your side from time to time. Your church family may. Even church leadership, right here at Anchored Fellowship, maybe we fail you from time to time. I did the best I could, but the only people that I could find for leadership, they were all human beings, every single one. Isn't that disappointing? But we did the best we could in putting together our leadership here for the fellowship. And because we're human beings, we may fail you. My only request to you is that we can't be there for you in your time of need if we don't know about it. So if you need us, you have to understand something. We aren't mind readers. And while we do pray, the Lord doesn't always tell us every single person in the fellowship that needs us at any given moment. So if you are in need and you need us to be there and support you and stand by your side, please let us know. Don't depend on us to find out about it through the grapevine. This church doesn't gossip. I've been through churches where you wouldn't have to worry about telling us. We'd know. Yeah. The grapevine was pretty active. It's not that way here. If you don't tell us your need, then we're not going to know about your need. But if you will tell us your need, I'll do everything I can, and so will our leadership here at this church, to support you and be by your side. But having said all that, don't get too caught up in all of that. Don't put too much trust in all of that, because we are not the head of the body. Jesus is the head of the body. He's the one that's given you the promises. When all else fails, when everyone else deserts, when there's no one else by your side, I assure you the Lord is by your side. The Lord stood by Paul, reading on in verse 11, and he said this: take courage, or be encouraged. Which means what? Said it last week. It means that Paul was discouraged. What, Arlen, you're kidding me. Paul discouraged? How is that even possible? I mean, the guy has been beaten. He has been stoned, likely to death, and nothing has stopped this guy And you're expecting us to believe that he's discouraged here? Well, he is still a human being. Yes, he's the Apostle Paul, but he's still a human being. And if the Lord said, Paul, be encouraged. Paul, take courage, take heart, cheer up, Paul. If the Lord had to say that to Paul, I assume it's because Paul was discouraged. He found himself discouraged. So the Lord says, take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome. Just a great confirmation and affirmation from the Lord to Paul here that, Paul, you did exactly what I wanted you to do. You have witnessed about me to the Jews again. Tried it before, it didn't work out. You tried it again. Good on you, Paul. You gave it a shot. I know it didn't go well. But, Paul, you did what you could, and that's exactly what I wanted. Now the Lord has a solid case against unbelief amongst the Jews there in Jerusalem. Because they have just thoroughly heard the gospel of Christ. Time and again. And now the Lord's saying, I've got all the information I need for perfect judgment against any Jew in Jerusalem that won't believe on me. Paul, you accomplished my will. Not the results you wanted, but you accomplished my will. And you're going to do the same thing for me in Rome. Just as I had you testify here in Jerusalem, I'm going to have you testify before the Gentile rulers in Rome. Humanly speaking, Paul had a lot to be discouraged about. His dream sermon before the unbelieving Jews turned into a nightmare. Not a dream come true, but a nightmare. He knows this was his last chance to get to try to win the Jews to Christ by faith. And Paul knows this will be the last time that he will ever see the holy city of Jerusalem. Just let that sink in. It's no wonder this guy is discouraged. This is it. And it didn't end the way that Paul was hoping for it to end. There's one tiny little bit of Paul's dream that remains. We find out about it in the book of Romans. Paul had already written the book of Romans by this point. And there in Romans chapter 1, verse 15, Paul says this to the Christians in Rome. He says, I am eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome. That was the last part of Paul's dream. You know, I want to be able to go down there and just win every Jew in Jerusalem to Christ. X that one out. Didn't happen. But here's the part of Paul's dream that remains. I want to go up there to Rome and visit those Christians in Rome. I want to be able to witness to them. I want to be able to minister to them. I want to be able to break bread, fellowship with them. I want to visit those churches up there and see if I can bless them in some way by sharing the Word of God. And now Paul would know that even that last bit of his dream that remains is very seriously in doubt. It is looking pretty impossible at this point. But the Lord has given Paul some comforting prophecy here, and that is, oh, you're gone to Rome, Paul. Just not quite the way that you were hoping for. And not to the end result that you were hoping for. You're not going to go there free on a missionary trip. You're not going to get to visit the churches up there in Rome. You're not going to get to fellowship and break bread. You're not going to get to minister. You're not going to get to widen out the grid and do missionary work for those Christian, that church or those churches there in Rome. None of that's going to happen. But, Paul, I am going to get you to Rome. And you are going to get to testify about me. Not to the church, not to the believers, but to Roman rulers. And, Paul, that's what I want. Verse 12. When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. Verse 13, there were more than 40 who made this conspiracy. Now, I have never had more than a few people at a time that wanted to kill me. It's a little embarrassing, I know. What can I say? I'm not the Apostle Paul. I'm going to try harder, though. But this is quite a few people to have against you agreeing together at the same time that, look, we just cannot go on with life as usual until that guy is dead. We just refuse to go on living until Paul is kaput. And so if you can imagine this, these 40 plus unbelieving Jews that hate Paul are fasting to the Lord for Paul's murder. They're essentially saying, Lord, we are going to abstain from food and drink. We're going to abstain from food and liquids until you bless our plan and we can get this guy Paul dead. Can you imagine fasting about something to the Lord? Now, you can only go 30 or 40 days without eating food, and you can survive that. You can only go about 3 to 5 days, sometimes less, sometimes a tiny bit more, without liquid. So the clock is ticking for these guys. I give them 3 to 5 days to get this done. 3 to 5 days to kill Paul before they either got to bail out on this fast and this oath, or getting it accomplished. And I got bad news for these guys. They're not going to get the Lord's help here. Paul is a servant of the Lord. So the Lord is more likely to kill y'all than to kill Paul. That's what I would say to them. Good luck. You're fasting that the Lord's going to help you kill Paul. The Lord isn't going to let Paul go until he's done with Paul. Verse 14. So they went to the chief priests and elders and said, we have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. And I don't know, maybe they changed their mind there about the liquids. Because when they're retelling this oath to the Sanhedrin, to the chief priests and the Sanhedrin, they don't mention the liquids. Maybe we better think a little bit harder about that. It might take a little longer to get this done. Let's not fast liquids. Let's just fast food. That'll give us more time. I don't know that that's what they did. I'm just pointing out that it's not there. So they're sharing this plot with the Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin, under Jewish law, the law of Moses, they have the right. The chief priest in the Sanhedrin has the right to nullify any presumptuous or foolish vows that are taken. That's how this worked. If you were a Jew and you were making a vow, you came to the temple or the tabernacle, if you go back far enough, and you told the priest your vow that you were making, and the priest could say, nope, that's foolish, I won't let you do that. Or the priest could confirm your vow and let you take that vow. And that's exactly what the chief priest in the Sanhedrin does here. They don't nullify the vow. They confirm the vow because they like the plan. Yes, let's get Paul dead. So verse 15, now therefore you, the chief priest, along with the council, the Sanhedrin, give notice to the tribune, Claudius Lysias, to bring him, Paul, down to you, as though you were going to determine the case more exactly. This whole thing is just outlandish. You've got these 40 plus men now ordering the Sanhedrin around, and the Sanhedrin's going to let them do that because they have the same goal in their hearts, and that is to get Paul killed. I was going to say something else there, and I forget what I was going to say. Oh, yeah. Look what we just read. They were asking the chief priest to tell a bold-faced lie in order to make this plot work. Can you imagine? Like, just think about, like, if you're a Catholic going up to the Pope and saying, here, I need to do something. Can you do me a favor? Now, it's not true, but can you tell my employer, or can you tell my priest back home and then make up this big lie? They're asking the head of the Sanhedrin. They're asking the religious ruler over all of Judaism at this time to tell a lie to situate Paul in a position where they can kill him. It's just unbelievable. And the chief priest and the council does not seem to mind the lie. So tell this lie so that, you know, you're going to pretend like you just want to hear more about Paul's case and get the record straight and solve the issue. And we are ready to kill him before he comes near. Verse 16. Now the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, so he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Well, that is an interesting plot twist, isn't it? Paul's nephew to the rescue. It is the first, the last, and the only time in the Bible that we have any kind of mention as to a relative of the Apostle Paul. His sister is mentioned, and his sister's son, which would be Paul's nephew. Is his sister saved? Is she a Christian? Is his nephew saved? Is his nephew a Christian? We have no clue. We have no other information in the Bible or in extra-biblical history about these two relatives of Paul. I would have to imagine that if you spent some time around Paul, you either converted to Christianity or you disowned him. Like, you just kicked him out of the family. So if I had to guess, I'd say they're either saved or they love Paul enough that they know he's in danger and they don't want him to be harmed. His nephew hears about the plot, and his nephew is going to come to the rescue here. And so we look at this and we say, was it a coincidence that his nephew found out about the plot? Oh, I don't think it was a coincidence. Because there are, you know, I wonder what James would have done if he found out about the plot, or the rest of the Jerusalem church. I don't think it's a coincidence at all that it's Paul's nephew that gets wind of this plot against Paul. I mean, come on, just really think about that. Not a coincidence at all. That was God intervening. That's what that was. That was God always being 20 steps ahead or so of the enemy and causing the enemy's plans against you to backfire. God just always has that way of outmaneuvering his enemy and then cutting his enemy off at the pass. I like to say there are no coincidences for believers in Christ. Now, that is all that the unbeliever believes in, coincidences. Because there's no fate, there's no destiny, there's no reason for anything. Their explanation of the universe and every living thing in the universe is coincidence. One after another. Here's where they start. There was nothing. And then what a coincidence. Nothing became something. What a coincidence. Nothing became something. And then something over millions and millions and millions of years. One coincidence after another. This constant coincidence of moving one step at a time closer to more complex and more complex and more complex life until we ultimately land at what we see observably in our world, and that is life and planetary movements that are so complex that even our brightest minds of all times have never even been able to come nearer to understanding it and explaining it. But all coincidence. And it just happens to be a coincidence that that process kept positively moving along for evolution. Just all coincidence. And it's a coincidence, you foolish people, when, you know, those little things in your life happen, but those little things compound and produce these wonderful, glorious moments and turns of life events for you. That's coincidence. It's all coincidence, the unbeliever would say. But the believer would say, there's no such thing as a coincidence. The believer believes in the sovereignty of God and the providence of God. So the enemy sets the battlefield against you, and then the Lord moves his pieces into place. In this case, Paul's nephew, and that what results is a victory for the Lord and you because you're the Lord's. That's how this works. It was a God thing. Could I go so far as to say it was a miracle? It was a miracle. I mean, this would be a top secret classified plot that they would do everything not to leak. And yet somehow, miraculously, I say, Paul's nephew finds out about it. I know when we think of miracles, we think of the big stuff. The lame man suddenly walking. The blind man suddenly seeing. The parting of the Red Sea. The sun standing still in the sky for a whole extra day. We think of the big things, and we miss the little things if we're not careful. It's no wonder that Jesus said so often, if you have ears to hear, let them hear. If you have eyes to see, let them see. It's no wonder he said that so often. Because he wasn't talking about physical eyes and physical ears. He was talking about spiritual eyes and spiritual ears, to where we can see what could be easily explained away by the unbeliever as coincidence after coincidence. But yet we can see it with eyes of faith, with spiritual eyes, hear it with spiritual ears. The miracles that God does for us on a regular basis, even in those little movements of our life that produce gigantic blessings for us in the end. Miracles from God. Let's not miss it. Let's always be looking for that. The sovereignty of God. The providence of God. Verse 17, Paul called one of the centurions and said, take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him. Verse 18, so he took him and brought him to the tribune and said, Paul, the prisoner called me and asked me to bring this young man, and the Greek word there for young man could mean anywhere from 12 to 40 years old. That was the general time frame for the usage of that word, young man, 12 to 40 years old. He asked me to bring this young man to you as he has something to say to you. Verse 19, the tribune took him by the hand, which probably indicates that Paul's nephew was on the younger end of this spectrum. He was probably 12, 13, or 14 years old, because if you don't already know, let me break it to you, manly men feel awkward with taking another man by the hand. It's just weird for us. We have a difficult enough time taking our wives by the hand. We are affectionately stopped up, most of us, in most cases. So the wife says, honey, would you just hold my hand for a minute? And the husband says, do you want to set the timer or do you want me to? That's men. What can I say? That's men. Not me, but most other men. So yeah, I think Paul's nephew is very young. He takes him by the hand and, going aside, asks him privately, what is it that you have to tell me? Verse 20. And he said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though he were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. Verse 21, but do not be persuaded by them. For more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for your consent. Verse 22. So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him or warning him, tell no one that you have informed me about these things. Verse 23. Then he called two of the centurions, and again, centurion means a ruler over 100, but by the first century, that was usually more like 80. A centurion was a ruler over 80. But that aside, these two centurions that are selected, they are going to be commanding and leading more than just two centuries, more than 160 men, more than 200 men even. It says, he called two of the centurions and said, get ready, 200 soldiers. That's infantry. with 70 horsemen. Now, that's not half horse, half man. This isn't Narnia. This is the Roman army. Not centaurs, centurions leading 70 horsemen. We would call that cavalry. So 200 infantry, 70 cavalry. And then he goes on to say 200 spearmen. And we would call that artillery. That was the closest thing to artillery they had. Spearmen. Not quite as good as the Patriot missile of our artillery, but that was the best they had. 200 spearmen on top of all of that. So 200 infantry, 70 cavalry, 200 artillery to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. So that's a total of 470 soldiers that will now be escorting Paul to his destination. Felix was actually the governor, the ruler in Caesarea. He was once a slave in Rome, but he grew up childhood friends with Claudius, who ends up becoming the Roman emperor in 41 AD. And when Claudius became the Roman emperor, what did he do? Well, he freed his buddy Felix. He freed him from being a slave, and he appointed him to a position of rule in Rome. It was the only time in history that a slave had ascended the ranks and become a Roman ruler. Roman historian Tacitus tells us that this guy Felix executed the prerogatives of a king, but with the spirit of a slave. So he was a slave. He ends up as a ruler, but he could never get past his past. He drug his past with him all his life, and that affected him even as a ruler. It was still in his psyche. He was still mad at the world because of his past. And I just think that's what you're always going to do if it's not that the Lord sets you free from your past. You're going to drag past slave mentality with you into your present, whatever that is. Doesn't matter how many times you get promoted, how much success you have or fame, how much money you make. If you have a slave mentality, that's where you're going to stay. And you're going to take that out on other people. You're never going to be happy, and you're never going to be settled. It's like I said when we were studying the exodus of Israel out of Egypt. I told you back then, it was super easy for God to get Israel out of Egypt. What was not easy was getting Egypt out of Israel. You know, it's being chained to your past, and I can't tell you how unnecessary that is for a Christian and stress it enough. It's totally unnecessary for you to be dragging by chains the things from your past that are holding you down right now. The Bible tells us that Christ has set us free for freedom's sake. I just love that. Why did he set us free? Just because he wanted us to be free. So if we call upon him this morning, whatever it is from our past that we're dragging by chains, if we're still slaves to our sin, if that's still got us bound and we've believed in Christ, but we haven't had the faith to ask the Lord and believe the Lord to snap those chains for us and free us from our past, today might be a good day to do that. He's given you the right to become the son of God. He's given you a right to become the daughter of God. He's given you the right to be free from the past that perhaps you're unnecessarily dragging along through life even this morning. Verse 24. Also provide mounts, and that means they're going to provide a mounted horse for Paul to ride to Caesarea. Also provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix the governor. So Claudius Lysias, the tribune, he has now upped security for the apostle Paul. And Paul will not be walking now, which is what would have happened had this plot not emerged. He would have walked from Jerusalem to Caesarea. Paul won't be walking now. He's going to be riding a horse. I know it's bumpy. I know it's not the easiest thing. And if you don't got a good back, maybe you don't want to do that. But this is essentially going from coach to first class in his travels from Jerusalem to Rome. God has taken this plot against Paul, and he has used that plot to upgrade Paul's traveling situation. Right? Accommodations. That's the word I was looking for. So I don't know, maybe there's a really good spiritual principle in there, that the Lord can take the plots against you by your enemy, and he can turn them and use that to improve your traveling accommodations in this life. I think there's a good spiritual principle there. I'm going to research that out, and I'm going to squeeze the juice out of it. I'm going to bring it back to you at some point. The Lord is so good at taking... it just hit me. The story of Joseph. What you meant for evil, God meant for good. God is going to turn all things out for good to those that love him and are the called according to his purpose. Thank you, Lord. We just did it. We're done. That's a good spiritual principle. The Lord can take the plots against you and improve your situation because of them. But let me condescend a little bit here, back down just for a moment, that 40 plus unbelieving Jews have taken an oath to fast until Paul is dead. They're going to do all that they can to kill Paul. And check out Paul, surrounded by 470 soldiers, 200 infantry, 70 cavalry, and 200 artillery. Look at how the Lord is protecting the Apostle Paul. And this is just a biblical truth that is, until it is your time to go, the Lord is going to continue his perfect streak, his perfect record of never failing to protect his people. Until it's your time to go, the Lord is going to protect you. You know, I've said it in here before that I truly believe that until God is done with me, I am indestructible. I really believe that. I don't test the Lord. I don't want to push my luck. I don't want to get outside of his will for my life. But I do believe that. I believe God has a plan for my life and that it's not done. And until it's done, I'm indestructible. He's not going to let me get taken down ahead of time. There are no oopses in heaven. So it's been my prayer for a long time. Lord, please, before you take me, one request. I want to teach through every chapter, every verse, every book, every word of the Bible before you take me home. Why do you think I'm going through the Bible so slowly with you all? I'm dragging my feet. I'm buying time. And I'm hoping that the Lord grants that to me. I think that maybe that's God's plan for my life. But I can't say for sure. He may not let me get there. And I would love to get there, because I'd love to get up in heaven and say what Jesus said concerning my ministry. It is finished. I taught through all of the Bible. And Lord, you can talk to me about the things I got wrong, but I did my best. I taught through all of the Bible. It is finished. But I'm not the Lord, and he has his will for my life. So the Lord just may say to me, I don't need you to be able to say it was finished. I only need you to be able to say it was attempted. The Lord's will. But until he's done, the enemy can't get to us. The enemy can't take us down. I believe that. Let's finish up with the letter that the tribune sent to Felix. We're running low on time here. Verse 25. And he wrote a letter to this effect. Verse 26. Claudius Lysias. And that's where he's named. I have shared that with you in advance, but that's where he is named for us. Claudius Lysias, to his excellency the governor Felix, greetings. Verse 27. This man, Paul, was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. Boy, is this guy a politician or what? I mean, that's a different story than we've been studying. You hear this guy? Yeah, I showed up and I rescued Paul. I found out he was a Roman citizen. They were about to tear him apart. I rescued the guy. I'm the good guy here. This is a politician trying to save his neck and keep his job. That's what this is. And he's not done revising history either. Verse 28. And desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. Verse 29. I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. Verse 30. And when it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against this man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him. So do you see how Claudius Lysias has justified the initial arrest? Oh, I only did this to get Paul to a place of safety. That was not true. He grabbed Paul, imprisoned him. He assumed he was the wrongdoer. He strung him up to scourge him. Paul stopped him. But different story. He's saying, you know, I arrested him initially to save his life. And then he goes on to say, he's only still under arrest for his own protection. I'm sending him up to you in protective custody for his own good. That's the only reason. He is a Roman citizen that has not been convicted of a crime and yet is still imprisoned. So, it's a politician trying to save his neck and keep his position. Verse 31. So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. That was 20 miles north from Jerusalem, en route to Caesarea. Verse 32. And on the next day, they returned to the barracks, letting the horsemen go on with them. So, if you didn't get that, the 200 infantry and the 200 artillery now returned back to base, Antonia Fortress, because Paul is past the danger zone. He's in a safe travel spot now, but the 70 cavalry go on with Paul. They continue on, escorting him to Caesarea ultimately. Verse 33. When they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. Verse 34. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, verse 35, he said, I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive. And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's Praetorium. Now, just real quickly, Herod's Praetorium was quite a nice place to be imprisoned. It was right on the beach of the Mediterranean. It actually was a resort. It was Herod's palatial resort. So this was like Paul getting to hang out in a beach resort made by Herod. They uncovered the ruins of this praetorium decades ago. And so we know the exact layout of it. We know that it was a colonnade building, which was common among the Romans. And at the center of the praetorium, just to give you an idea how fancy this was, I mean, they were close, right to the edge of the beach. You can look at this online, look at pictures of it. Right on the edge of the beach there, but in the center of the praetorium, there was this huge swimming pool. It was 60 feet wide and 118 feet long, pretty much double the length of our sanctuary here. And Just an immaculate and a wonderful place for Paul to hang out. So Paul is unofficially arrested, but officially he's free. Officially he's just waiting for trial. He has a trial coming up. So here's the extent of his limitations. Paul, stay here. You can't leave here. We're going to read this next week that Paul has the freedom to have friends come and go. They can bring him whatever they want. He's not technically under arrest. But he needs to stay there at the beach resort of Herod. And I think Paul would probably be saying, that's okay with me. I don't mind sticking around. I have no intentions of leaving. I can pray and I can study and I can write epistles from here and I can get visitors from here. So this is A-okay, a little bit of R&R kicking back at the end part of my ministry here. So as Jonathan Rumi from The Chosen would say, not too shabby. Not too shabby for Paul. And speaking of, The Chosen is officially out, season 4, episodes 1 through 3 in theaters. Get to see that this week if you would like to coordinate attending that with me and Maggie. We're planning to do that this week. Reach out to us, let us know, and we'll see if we can coordinate that. Go ahead and stand with me. Worship team, come on up.